Good afternoon. So hopefully you're here for 4414 operating systems. So we have lectures. So just some logistics first. So lectures, I am going to be recording lectures. I'm not going to take attendance. If you aren't watching live, either in the future or if you're looking at the recording of this, I recommend writing down questions so you like actually ask them rather than forgetting to ask them, especially if no one during the live lecture asked the question you had. You can ask via Piazza, office hours, and so on. There's a course webpage. It's linked off Colab. It has most of the logistics information about this course on it, including the assignments that will be existing in the future. There will be office hours. They will be indicated on a calendar, which isn't filled in yet because I need to talk to my TAs, and my TAs need to figure out when they're available, and I need to figure out when I should be available to not oversaturate times with my TAs and also schedule meetings with my TAs. But we'll be indicated on a calendar website. We'll have some remote office hours, which will use Discord and online queue that is separate from Discord, and in-person office hours, which, depending on the situation of the day, may use the online queue or may use like writing names on a board, or maybe we have three people in the office hours and we don't bother doing anything formal. So this course is going to have some programming assignments. There's mostly in C or C++. I expect to have one in Python. These are 1 to 2 week programming assignments. If there's 2 weeks, there's a checkpoint submission. The checkpoint submission is because I have found that giving a 2 week assignment and telling people, no, really, it's probably twice as much work as a 1 week assignment, doesn't get the point across. So I need to have something due, even though it's going to be worth a lot less than the final submission. And the 2 week assignments are worth roughly twice as much because they're roughly twice as much work. Some of our assignments are going to use a teaching operating system. So meaning we're going to have an operating system that's very simple. It's called XV6. It's based on 6th edition Unix, which was a historical operating system that was used as a basis because people had the source code lying around. In fact, you can buy a copy of the source code of 6th edition Unix, the original version, as a book. And before that, it was passed around illegally on photocopies. And this clone of that was built by some people at MIT. The version we're going to use runs on 32-bit x86, which I've chosen to use because from 2150, you theoretically are kind of familiar with x86 assembly, so that won't be such a big amount of explanation when we have the very small pieces of the OS which are written in assembly to look at. The people at MIT are currently have a RISC-V version, which is more recent, but not the one we're going to be using. But this is it's a teaching OS. It's kind of doesn't support all the features you'd expect from an operating system you'd want to use for something in the real world. But it's enough that it should like actually boot on an x86 machine if you wanted to do that. We're not going to. We're going to use an emulator because doing development of an OS on a physical machine is very annoying compared to doing it on an emulator. We're also going to have quizzes. So the quizzes will be online, open book, open notes, open computer, open internet. Generally, just don't get assistance from other people about the particular quiz questions. Like you can ask, like, I don't understand this topic we talked about, but not like this, you know, what is the number that you compute from this that's in the quiz question? They'll start after next week. We'll talk more about logistics for that next Thursday. I'm expecting to have a final exam, probably a take-home exam with 24 hours overlapping the official final time after what happened last semester. I think it's probably not worth planning on doing an in-person exam this semester. So, those plans are in flux. I will make some announcement later. We have a scheduled final exam time, which is on the exam calendar, the official one, that is combined for both sections. With that, the final exam, in whatever form it takes, will overlap with. There's a late policy. It's on the website. You can read it. I suggest being familiar with it if it ever might come up. There is a recommended textbook. I'm not requiring any textbook, but I think this textbook is useful, and I've based some of the lecture material on it. So Anderson and Dahlin, Operating Systems Principles and Practice. I also mentioned an alternate textbook, Arpeggio de Sue's Operating Systems 3 Easy Pieces, which is available as free PDFs from the authors. Or you can get a hard copy like this for like 20 bucks. Arpeggio de Sue is a bit more terse than Anderson Dahlin, which is one reason I recommend it. And there's a few topics that are only covered in Arpeggio de Sue, which we'll use, but I think for the most part, most people would find Anderson Dahlin easier to read, but they're both fine textbooks, and Arpeggio de Sue is available for free legitimately if that's a concern for you. Note on cheating. So homeworks are individual. That means please, do it yourself. No code from prior semesters. Don't share code with other students. Don't share pseudocode with other students or detailed description of code. Don't find code on the internet and use it. With limited exceptions, which is why I'm talking about this more than I might in some other classes. So if you're solving problems that clearly aren't the point of the assignment. So for example, we're going to have a problem for writing a shell. A shell is a program like your command line, which runs other programs. If you use code to like split up a string in that, that's not the point of the assignment. The point of the assignment is how to run other programs. That's fine. You can use it. If you do so, you need to credit in your code. So when I look at your code and I say, that doesn't look like code you wrote, I know what happened. But if it's clearly not the point of the assignment, it's fine. Otherwise, don't do it. If you have questions about whether something counts, ask the course staff. Probably to ask me, because the TAs will probably ask, delegate to me on that. Don't do it. Also on the quizzes. Quizzes are individual. So they're open book, open notes, open internet, open computer. So you can like take out a compiler. Like that's fine. But don't like share answers. Don't IM friends for answers. Don't ask on Stack Overflow for answers. Yeah. They're individual. You can ask TAs about the quiz questions, but they can't generally answer useful things besides general information about the topic before it's due. I'm not going to police whether the TAs told you things they're not supposed to tell you. That's their job, not yours. Okay. And speaking of getting help, so we have Piazza. We have TA in my office hours. You can also email me if none of those work, though I probably prefer we do one of the higher options. So questions about course logistics. So I rush through all that. Okay, so let's start talking about operating systems. So we're going to talk about what an operating system is. That's kind of an important thing for this class. And if you look for a definition of that, you won't find many very satisfying ones, because in practice, there's not agreement on what is an operating system. Some people will say something is a part of the OS, versus some people will say, no, that's just a program or a library, something that you run with an OS. But there's a whole lot of things where you won't find people agreeing on which is which. So for example, code that allows you to move windows on the screen. Some people will tell you that's part of the operating system. Of course, it's. And some people will tell you, well, no, that's just a program you're running on some operating system that lets you do that. Or is code that supports printers, is that part of the OS? Some people say, yeah, of course, it's IO, that's classically an OS function. Some people say, no, that's just a program you're running. It's nothing to do with what the OS is. We're not gonna worry about resolving these disputes. I'm not gonna tell you that the answer is yes or no for either of those things being part of the OS. We're gonna give general principles about what an operating system is, and we're gonna look at things that we think are useful to know that are in that space, regardless of whether all the things we'll be looking at really are part of the OS or not. And sort of one way of looking at what does operating system mean versus what does it maybe not mean is to start from sort of the job of operating. What is that? And there used to be a job called a computer operator. Here are some file pictures from the National Library of Medicine of people who were their computer operators. And, you know, this was a job that involved, like, actually operating a computer and loading things, programs, and running programs. So the job which, you know, could be automated more. And one way of thinking about where an operating system, that idea comes from, is that, well, you know, an operating system is doing a bunch of that operating that used to have to be done manually. So with that in mind, let's look at sort of our two textbooks' definitions. So Anderson Dahlin says an operating system is software that manages a computer's resources. So resources are going to be things like the memory, the processor, the things that kick input and output. Arpeggio de Sue doesn't look from that direction. Doesn't look at resources, doesn't look at things to be, you know, taken care of. It looks from a different perspective. It says it provides a virtual machine that is more convenient than the real machine. And you might say these are completely different definitions, and they aren't. They're just different emphasis. And a common theme we'll see with these is that the operating system is really about providing an interface that's better than a raw machine would be. So that we could write programs and have software that uses a machine directly, and that's not something we want to do. That for some reason, we want to write programs on top of this other piece of software we call an operating system that is going to do things that make it more convenient than using the raw base machine. And Anderson Dahlin has this taxonomy of things that operating systems do that sort of are part of that role of making the machine more convenient. These are all things that like look like managing resources, but are sort of, in some sense, about being a more convenient thing. So one part of that taxonomy that Anderson Dahlin uses that say that the OS is a referee, that we have resources that need to be somehow divided up or among different programs or users, or which need to be, where one user needs to be allowed to use it, another user not, something like that. So we call resource sharing and protection, where protection means that making so a program can't interfere with other programs or the OS. So like if it goes haywire or if it's malicious. Another role that Anderson Dahlin has is this idea they call the illusionist role, that the OS creates the illusion that the machine is really nice and convenient to use. So it has these, we have these clean abstractions that are easy to use. When we look at, you know, if we take out the manual for an actual piece of hardware, often it will be quite arcane and complicated in ways that would not be convenient to program, and an operating system is going to hide that from us. Another thing Anderson Dahlin says OSs do is provide glue, that there's these common services. There's some things that programs want implemented that we don't want to have every program implement for itself. So one example is storage, that we don't want to have every program write the code to make directories work. We just want directories to be implemented once and all the programs to use that. Now there is windowing systems, that we want the code for displaying windows on a screen, every program shouldn't have to make its own version of that. We just want one version of that that everyone can use together. There's a whole bunch of other services like that that are common to the system that, yes, you could implement, you know, because the operating system did it, but don't make sense to have, you know, every program have its own version of, and in fact probably need to be shared between programs. Like if we think of directories, we kind of want, you know, two programs to have the same idea what how directories work. So we might as well just have one implementation. So let's think about these roles. So I have that referee role, that illusionist role. So start with the referee role. Can someone give me an example of how you, using an operating system, writing programs or running programs, would have noticed, you know, that some operating system is taking this referee role, that's doing some resource sharing or protection? Like, what is a way in which we as programmers or as users of a system would have noticed that? Over there. Okay, so the OS, so programs with get resources based on demand. So is that somehow programs can request resources and get them, and programs that don't request resources don't get those resources. So like one way you've noticed this like is like math, right? You get, if you ask for memory, you get it, otherwise you don't. Okay, so other answers? Yeah.
Stuff that I do in one program does not affect any other program.
So stuff that you do in one program doesn't affect other programs. Sort of. So what one program does. Does not affect others. Mostly. So we can think of some exceptions to that, but for the most part, you know, yeah, if you do something in one program, it's not going to change what another program does. Like, there's exceptions, like if you write a file, that might do it, but they're kind of explicit. Okay, any others people have on their minds? Yeah. Okay, so sort of admin / sudo access is needed for thing. Needed to do certain things. That you need these. You need to do an extra step to take certain operations. Yeah. So those are all some good examples of the referee role. So how about the illusionist role? So someone, yeah. Question? So yeah, we mentioned files and folders. So as we'll learn later in the semester, the disk, the hard drives or SSDs, they are not organized in terms of files or folders. They just have, they're basically like in a big array. That's not how you access them. Sort of instead of array, instead of numbered sectors, which is what the sort of raw interface to the disk looks like. So other examples of the illusionist role? Yeah.
The idea of a desktop?
So desktop, yes. So that's an abstraction that isn't. Anything else think of? Other people's minds. So I guess another example that will come up shortly I'll give is that sort of writing to a file is about the same as writing to the screen. That's a big abstraction. Like the hardware interfaces for those two things are very different, but how we program them is essentially the same. It's like printf or print whatever in your programming language, like looks the same. It's not really that way in the hardware. That's something the OS has done. Made this illusion that they're basically the same operation. Okay, so questions on our roles from Anderson Bell. Okay, so the perspective Arpeggio Desu had was that they said a virtual machine, and you might find this confusing because you think of virtual machines as something that let you run like other OSs. And there's kind of a spectrum. So we can think of the operating system, there's this physical machine interface that the operating system uses. that implements what we'll call a virtual machine interface. And that virtual machine interface can span the spectrum from what I'll call a system virtual machine, which is like what VirtualBox, VMware, Hyper-V, and so on implement. So they provide an interface which imitates a physical interface, possibly a physical interface of a different piece of hardware, but a physical interface that like hardware would have. And the reason we have system virtual machines is because they're convenient for letting us like run operating systems that are meant to run on hardware because they imitate hardware. And on the sort of other spectrum, end of the spectrum, we have what we'll call a process virtual machine. And that's where, rather than the interface being based on what hardware does, the interface is chosen to be convenient. So it's chosen to be something that applications can be easily written in. And that's typically the type of virtual machine we'll be implementing. That's the one you've been used to programming. So that it doesn't look like the real hardware, and it doesn't look like any real hardware. Because it's a machine designed for writing programs. And you notice I have this as a spectrum because if you look at how sort of system virtual machines work, there's actually a big debate in sort of designing those about how much like real hardware do you make it? How many of these features that we see in traditional OSs where we have these things chosen for applications do we actually want to implement in sort of something like VirtualBox? And the answer is often more than nothing. So we're not going to be talking mostly about how to implement system virtual machines. We might spend a day or two about on that at the end of the semester. So we're going to be talking about this process virtual machine. And in the process virtual machine, we're going to provide these abstractions, which are really different from the abstractions of real hardware. So instead of having processors, we're going to have this abstraction we call a thread. Instead of having page tables, which you may have learned about in the prior course, we're going to have memory allocation, like malloc and so on. Instead of having these raw devices, like hard drives, we're going to have files. And in addition to the interfaces for these new versions of the abstractions being more convenient, they're going to be more capable. So when we provide these threads that are kind of like processors, we can let a program have a virtually infinite number of threads, even though obviously physical hardware can't let you have a virtually infinite number of processors. When we provide memory allocation functions, the program is never going to need to be concerned about where exactly is this memory going to be placed physically. It's just going to ask for memory and get it. When we have files, we're going to have this common interface no matter what type of device we're talking to. No matter if it's a file that's stored on a remote server, or a file that's stored on a local hard drive, or the file is actually the discrete terminal we're outputting to, you know, we're going to have this common interface, and the interface we're going to look at is this open, read, write, and close interface. Those are our key operations, and we don't need to care much about what type of device it actually implements that. Okay, so let's look at processes. So a process, as you might guess, is sort of the key abstraction of the process virtual machine. And a process is sort of this container that represents a running application. And it consists of a thread or multiple threads, which, remember, is kind of like a CPU, a processor, and an address space, which is going to be kind of like a memory. So basically, it gives you sort of the key components of an independent machine for your application, that you have something that looks like a processor and something that looks like memory for your program. These work differently than the real processor and real memory, but you know, provide the same type of functionality. So a thread gives you the illusion of your own processor. You have your own program counter, meaning your own currently executing instruction, and therefore your own stream of instructions that are being run. your own registers, apparently, your own value of, you know, stack pointer and so on. Your address space, you have your own memory that values that a pointer points to in your process, you know, are different than other processes because each of them have their own memory. And this is the key abstraction we're going to talk about implementing and spend most of our time talking about, how we provide the process abstraction. So with that in mind, we can say, okay, so we have our applications. They're written to use these threads, these address spaces, these processes, files, these abstractions that the OS provides. And we can kind of view the OS as translating those to whatever the hardware interface is. That we have interrupts and special registers that the hardware uses. We have IO buses, things we'll talk about later. And the OS is just a translation layer from one interface to another. And the hope is that the application view is that, you know, the machine we're working with is the operating system. That's why we said process virtual machine, that you don't know when you're writing a program what interrupts are. You don't need to know that, because that's all an operating system implementation detail. You need to know about files and threads and so on. And this is both not only more convenient to program, but also kind of future-proof, that because this is the interface you're programming against, that if the OS changes, you're not going to have to deal with, you know, sorry, if the hardware changes, the OS is going to have the same interface. So you're not going to have to deal with that the OS needed to change to implement the same interface. You write to that interface, you work on future hardware. And the OS job is just to translate these abstractions from one interface to another. So for example, if I'm running an application, I have a process. We tell you the process consists of threads and an address space primarily. So we'll have threads, which will have registers that, when the process is running, will be mapped to physical registers on the processor. It will have an address space, which will be mapped to some memory in the big pool of memory in our system. And the system we'll provide is going to be more capable than the one that we started with, so we could have another application. And it's going to have its own thread and its own address space. So its address space is going to be mapped to a different set of memory. So we can have two processes think, oh, I have a memory to myself, and they do. And it's implemented by using two independent parts of a bigger memory. And both of them think, I have a processor to myself. And in this example, well, we only have one processor, but our operating system is going to handle hiding that from these programs. And the typical mechanism that we're going to talk about more probably next time is that, well, one process is going to get to use the C processor, and the other process won't at that time. But that's fine. We're going to keep the data for the other process in memory, and at some point in time, we'll let it use the processor and have the first process not use it. That will divide up the processor among these two programs by, you know, letting them borrow it for brief amounts of time, and will hide the fact that they don't actually have the processor all the time from them. So another thing our programs need to do that's kind of important is that we need to do input and output. And the abstraction we're going to talk about for that is files. And you might say, wait, files? Files are just things on disk, and that's not how we're going to view files. Files are how we're going to represent an interface to any device. And you've kind of seen this when you've programmed, that when you read from the keyboard, you're using the same functions in your typical programming languages that you'd use to read from a file, or at least you can. So we're going to talk about taking this single interface that we're most familiar with for files on disk, but this is also how we're going to provide access to keyboards, to networks, to the monitor and so on, is that we're going to provide it like a file. Yes, we could provide some other interface, but this is going to be our example. And why is it our example? Because it's the Unix example of sort of a single interface to deal with all sorts of devices. And each of our processes is going to have some number of files that they have open. And the operating system is going to translate those file accesses, depending on the type of file, to accesses to the actual disk, to the actual keyboard, to the actual mouse, and so on. So questions about these abstractions we've looked at so far? Now, another piece of functionality which kind of maybe doesn't fit so well is sort of security and protection. That, you know, if I try to access things that I'm not supposed to, things need to behave predictably. And sort of an example of this is that, you know, if I try to access memory that isn't part of my address space, something needs to happen. And we could say, well, maybe we don't care, right? I've made an error. But we need it to be the case that my program doesn't like cause the other programs to break when that happens. And sort of one way we see this is that somehow there's some mechanism where if I access something I'm not supposed to, I get like a segmentation fault. Rather, my program crashes rather than I access something that's not part of my address space. So this is kind of something that's maybe doesn't fit so well into talking about these abstractions, but a key sort of aspect of, you know, the way our process works is that this is the interface I have for my memory and my processor, and I don't get access to other things in addition. Like if I don't follow the interface provided to me by the OS, things just won't work. I'm not going to like break things for everyone else. So one thing you've seen in what I've shown you here is I talked about, oh, we're using files. And files aren't the only interface that we could use to, you know, talk to say how we're going to interface with devices. And similarly, actually, threads and address spaces aren't the only interface we could use to say how we access processors and memory from a program. They're just the one we're going to be learning because it's what most of the operating systems we're familiar with implement, and most of the ones that people seem to want to make today. And in particular, we're going to be doing a case study of sort of the Unix design. So I'm going to talk about sort of what the Unix design looks like. And that in the Unix design, we have our applications. And you might say, oh, they're written on top of the operating system. We'll get to whether that's really true later. And in the applications, we have them using sort of the standard library, as we'll call it. So, you know, you use like malloc and printf, and you might consider those part of the operating system. Those are like the functionalities of outputting to a file, opening a file, to accessing memory, and so on. And there's similar functions you might call to like start a new program. And those are all part of the standard library. And in addition, there's sort of a set of programs that are provided with the app, with the operating system that are kind of essential to using the machine, like the program which shows up when you boot the machine and lets you log in. And these standard libraries, well, they need to do things that your program can't directly do. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to need to talk to a component of the OS we'll call the kernel. And why are we going to call it the kernel? Well, because I could have showed this as, oh, our applications, they have to talk to the hardware, right? They're running on a machine. There's an interface the hardware provides. Our applications can use that. That's not how things are set up in a Unix-like design, pretty much the design of most OSs you'll use today. There's kind of two versions of that hardware interface. There's a user mode version, which is limited, where some operations just aren't allowed. And there's a kernel mode version, which is more complete, where more operations are allowed. And the way things are going to work is that when we want to do some operation that requires the complete interface, we're going to have to run the piece of code that is running in this kernel mode interface, which we'll call the kernel. So it's called the kernel because it runs with extra privileges as far as the hardware concerns. That when the hardware runs it, it has some flag it's tracking that says, yes, this piece of code is allowed to do more things. And whenever it returns to your libraries or applications, that flag is turned off. You get this more limited interface. And we have to have a way of making a request to that kernel. And that interface is going to be what we'll call the system call interface. That will make what we'll call system calls, which will kind of look like function calls. They aren't really function calls, but they'll look like them. That will communicate with the kernel. And the kernel will do the operations you want. Now, in this Unix design, this kernel implements a whole lot of things, some of which we will talk about later in the semester, some of which we won't. This is not always how people build operating systems atop this sort of kernel mode slash user mode hardware support. Often people maybe want to have less stuff done in kernel mode. That's not the Unix design, the traditional Unix design. The traditional Unix design is that, you know, once we get to this kernel part, we stay there, we have this big piece of code that does all the operations that might need these full complete interface. There's some other designs, which we probably won't talk about, commonly known as microkernels, where they try to minimize that more, but it makes things more complicated in ways we'll probably not discuss. So we have this kernel mode where we have this complete interface, and our applications need to go through the system call interface to get to that functionality, and that's going to include actually a lot of stuff. Because we can't, for example, allocate memory without going through that kernel mode interface. We can't talk to most devices without going through that kernel mode interface. So basically the things that the user mode interface to the hardware is going to allow is probably like running instructions and accessing memory that is already allocated to us. Which is a lot, but not the sort of things we think about as far as what the OS provides as functionality. Some questions about sort of this overall Unix design. Okay, so one thing that I mentioned about the definition of OS not being consistent, some people will say the OS is that standard library, those standard programs, and the kernel. Some people will say, oh, no. The OS is the kernel. I'm not going to say who's right. I'm just telling you that's a big point of dispute. And there's not only no consensus on sort of where the dividing line is, like you can replace the two components separately. Like you can have a completely different standard library running on top of the same kernel. Is that the same OS or not? You could take a standard library and have it run on a different kernel, like a completely rewritten one, and have it still work. So, you know, it's not really clear that like these are coupled together. And there's not consensus on what is the OS, and we're not going to care. Now, I will say that generally, if it's in the kernel, probably people will consider it part of the OS, even if arguably it didn't need to be. And most of what we're going to be talking about for the first few parts of this course are going to be stuff in the kernel. mentioned looking at this user mode versus kernel mode. One thing that the OS relies on the hardware doing to influence functionality. So we're going to look at operating systems that are built with help from the hardware, that the hardware is going to be designed for writing operating systems. And this is how pretty much all current operating systems you've used work. It's not actually necessary to have your computer designed this way, but this is what people have, you know, who design hardware have decided on, is that we're going to have hardware help out operating system writers by providing this extra functionality. And one piece of extra functionality is that they'll have this kernel mode versus user mode. And this is so the people who write the operating system can run applications, quote unquote, directly on the processor without letting the application also do anything with the machine. And this is hardware support provided for that, because it's a lot easier to write an OS with this support than it would be without. You still could, and you still could implement protection, meaning you still could make it so programs can't do things they're not allowed to, but you need to do something a lot more complicated. What could you do? You could, for example, check the code before you let it run and make sure that it doesn't do anything that you don't want to allow. That's a real strategy that has been implemented, but it's not what modern OSs have decided to do. They've decided instead that we're going to rely on the hardware having a flag we can turn on to say, make sure this program doesn't do anything, you know, that's this more dangerous functionality. That's that user mode flag. So this is hardware support to make it easier to write an operating system. And the OS is going to use this to make sure that operations that are special only happen as the OS decides, because the OS controls what runs in kernel mode. And in the Unix design, we're only ever going to run this thing we call the kernel in kernel mode. We're not going to ever run any application in kernel mode under any circumstances. And there are no exceptions to this. Sudo is not an exception to this. We're never going to do it. The second big mechanism we need for this idea that we're just going to run the code directly is we need some way of making sure programs only access memory they're supposed to. And our mechanism for that is going to be address translation, that there's going to be a mapping set by the operating system so that when a program accesses memory addresses, it's going to access addresses chosen by a function the OS chooses. And if that function doesn't have a mapping, it's going to trigger an error. It's going to run the OS. And this is going to keep programs from accessing, for example, the OS's memory and like overwriting the OS's memory, which would be really bad if we care about what we call protection, that a program that is malicious or, you know, has some bug can't cause the OS to break or other programs to break. So these are sort of the two key mechanisms that we're going to talk about using to implement operating systems, implement that core process functionality that we expect of our operating systems. As I mentioned, they're not the only way you could do this, but all current hardware has this, and pretty much every OS you've ever used or thought of using uses these mechanisms. So we're going to talk about them and how to use them. Now, there's one other hardware mechanism we need in addition to this, which is going to be exceptions. And the reason we need that is that, well, if we run a program actually on the processor directly, and like a key press happens, or the program is running for too long, we need some way of stopping it. If we want to share the, you know, keyboard and the processor with other programs. You mentioned that, oh, we're going to have two programs using one processor, and we're going to like move one program off the processor. We have to have that happen somehow. And we want that to happen even if that one program that's using the processor isn't trying to give up the processor, which makes sense because it thinks it owns the processor. The idea of a thread is it looks like you have a processor to yourself. And it really wouldn't look like a processor if you had to like periodically ask the OS, hey, can I still be running? So instead, the hardware is going to provide us some help here. And it's going to have a way of running the OS instead of a program that has been running for either too long or instead of, you know, not responding to some external event like a key press. It's going to run the OS in response to that. There's going to be hardware support for doing that because the program we're running is not going to be written to be aware of that need. And it shouldn't be because the thread abstraction we want to provide is that it looks like a processor that you have dedicated to yourself. You don't have to worry about other things that are going on in the machine. Those are things for the OS. And this exception mechanism is going to be tightly tied to that user mode, kernel mode idea. The exception is going to move into kernel mode. So this is how we're going to start running in kernel mode. And in fact, typically going to be the only way we're going to start executing in kernel mode. So if you want to execute in kernel mode, an exception needs to happen. So this means that in addition to exceptions happening from like a key press or a program running for too long, exceptions are also the mechanism we're going to use to do that system call interface that I showed on this diagram here of the standard library decides it needs to do something that needs this kernel mode interface. It's going to trigger an exception, and that's what that system call interface box represents. We'll talk about what that looks like in more detail in a bit. So questions about this idea of exceptions and switching to kernel mode? Okay. So if you've taken 30 through 30, you've probably seen a bunch of terminology for different kinds of exceptions, and you may have seen possibly different terminology in the equivalent ECE course. So on 30 through 30, we talk about exceptions that are triggered by an external event, like a key press, or a timer expiring, or something coming in on the network, which are that we called interrupts there. That's one way we can have exceptions. It's something external to the program happens. Exceptions are also how the processor deals with a program that's running in user mode doing things that don't make sense, like invalid memory accesses, dividing by zero, and so on. And in 30 through 30, we call those faults. We also mentioned that it's how we request the kernel do things that we can't do if we're implementing those standard libraries, like to access a file or something like that. And those are going to be what we call 30-30 traps or system calls. And there's this fourth category we mentioned in 30-30 briefly, called aborts, which is for something in the hardware broke, like if the memory chip is faulty, well, we want to tell the OS about it, and it doesn't really fit into any of these other categories. Now, I think this taxonomy is useful because it tells us, oh, there's lots of reasons the processor might want to run the OS. And these are all things that are we need to run the OS because the operating system is going to decide what to do about it because it's managing multiple applications. And there's shared resources. It's not so useful in that no one agrees on these terms. I think I mentioned this in 30 through 30. No one agrees on these terms, so we're not going to care about which of these terms we use. I just want you to know, oh, there's these different reasons we can have exceptions. They're, you know, going to be handled a bit differently. And in particular, I mentioned we're using the teaching OS XV6. And XV6, everything's a trap. That's just the name they use. Doesn't matter what the cause is, they call it a trap. And sometimes it's an interrupt. Why is it an interrupt sometimes? Because if you look at Intel's manual calls everything an interrupt. And the processor that, I suspect, I'm not sure, that the PDP-10 that the original was written for call everything a trap. And just going to warn you that that's what the terminology you use. So we're not going to like care about being careful about which names we use for which type. We'll just say an exception caused by, you know, accessing out of bounds memory or something like that. We need to be explicit. So in the real world, like, it varies all over the place. And this is one example of that. So let's get back to our example of deliberately triggered exceptions. So that we mentioned that we had a whole bunch of things where the kernel needs to do something. We need to do something in kernel mode. Like, if we want to allocate memory, we need to change the address space that's going to require that kernel mode. If we want to read or write to a file or some other device, that's going to need to access kernel mode. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to trigger an exception deliberately. And the mechanism for that is that there's going to be some instruction to trigger an exception. It's going to work like a normal exception, but the standard library is going to contain that special instruction to start the OS executing. And the OS is going to have a handler for this exception, and it's just going to set, which is code that the processor will run when that exception happens. And it's going to say, oh, this is not like a divide by zero. This is the program wants me to do something. Let me do it for it. Or the program wants me to do something, but I don't want to let it do that. Let me crash it. You know, it's going to have some logic based on the request rather than logic based on, oh, the processor's telling me the program divided by zero what I want to do. And we'll look at what that looks like in XV6 as probably our next big topic. But before that, just a little interlude. So let's say we're running a bunch of programs, running process A. A prompts for input. Then it waits to read a key press. And while it's waiting, the OS is going to run some other program because we don't want to just leave the CPU empty. So it's going to run program B for a bit, then program C for a bit. Then a key press happens, and it runs program A because A was waiting. Now it's ready to run. And then A exits. So how many exceptions do you think should happen on this? So I'll give you 30, 45 seconds to count. And talk with your neighbor, see if you agree. Thank you. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we need, let's say, at least three, at least four, at least five, at least six, at least seven, at least eight, at least nine? Okay, so no one going higher. Okay, so our sort of consensus was sort of somewhere between like four and six, probably more on the six side. Let's go through counting. So to prompt for input, this involves communicating with the monitor or the network or some sort of output device. So that's going to be a kernel mode only. Only because the output device is shared. So we know it has to use kernel mode because the OS needs to manage sharing that, so we can't let programs access that directly, whatever it uses the prompt for input. So that's going to be one exception, which is going to be a system call. Then we need to wait to read a key press. So that's asking the OS to communicate with another device. So that's going to be a system call for that. And part of that request from the OS, the way the OS is going to satisfy it, it's going to run some other programs. Now, when we run program B, we want to run program B in user mode, and we need to switch back to kernel mode in order to switch to program C, because otherwise we'd be allowing program B to access program C's things. So there's going to be an exception, you know, causing the switch, which we can't do from user mode. We need extra permissions to do that because we can't access another program's things directly. At least not if programs are protected from each other. Then when the key press happens, the OS needs to switch. That's going to be another exception to run A. So this is from keyboard input. And the OS handles that by switching to A. And then A exits. When A exits, what's going to happen? Well, we went to run a different program, probably. The OS needs to get involved. So that's going to be another exception. So that's probably going to be a system call, in fact, to exit. So I count five. It's my count. But we could say maybe this prompting, this might involve maybe more, because maybe we print like character by character with separate system calls. Could be more. And we could imagine sort of some more operations when program B is running and program C is running. So it could be more than five, but a minimum of five. Questions? Yes?
Why can't we combine like the first and the second exception? Because in the first exception, the system...
Okay, so the question is, why couldn't we have one system call for this? So I guess, yes. So we absolutely could. So your proposal is that we have a sort of one prompt and read syscall. So we absolutely could have that. So that is typically not something an operating system will do. Typically, the write and read operations are going to be separate system calls, but we could absolutely have one system call that does them both. And I guess the issue with providing that is you have to think of how many other sort of combined system calls you're going to implement and how complicated is that interface going to get. But you could do that, and it's not unreasonable. But it's very, very uncommon. Yes?
So the prompt just means like writing out the instructions for like what the user should input, right?
So by prompt for input, I mean like print enter name colon or whatever. Yes. Question? Yes?
Is a system call that deliberately triggered exception?
Question, is a system call deliberately triggered exception? Yes.
So, can you explain the difference between deliberately triggered exception and not deliberately triggered?
So, can I explain the difference between deliberately triggered and not deliberately triggered? Sure. So a system call is what the program is doing. The person writing the program knew they couldn't do it themselves, so they wrote code that would cause an exception to happen. So versus, for example, maybe the OS switched from program B to C because program B was just running all the time and it decided it ran for too long. That's not something that program B wrote to do that. So that wasn't deliberately triggered in the sense I'm talking about. Or when the key press happens, that's not something program C was doing. That's something that was external. Maybe a more subtle example of not deliberately triggered is like if you divide by zero, typically your intention wasn't to run the OS. That's what's going to happen, but I wouldn't call that a deliberately triggered exception. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Switch from program A to B, do you need to enter kernel mode?
Question, when we switch from program A to B, do we need to enter kernel mode? Yes. But we could take advantage of the fact that we enter kernel mode for the read system call to do that. So we don't need a separate exception to cause that to happen.
Yeah,
question.
So in this case, isn't that the exception one is already made the system in the kernel mode, so that the second exception...
So the question is, why doesn't exception one cause the read a key press to happen in kernel mode?
Yeah, yeah.
So if the request we made in exception one was just to write out the prompt, then the OS has to go back to the program to figure out what to do next. And that's and it always runs the program in user mode, so it would go back to the program in user mode. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes.
What needs to happen for the OS to switch back to, not the OS, for the execution to switch back to user mode? Like, is there something special that needs to happen?
Question is, how does the OS switch back to user mode? And there's going to be a special instruction to do that. Because indeed, like if we just do a normal like jump to the program, that's not going to do it. So we need some special instruction. The hardware is going to provide that as part of its providing this kernel mode user mode support. Other questions? Okay. So let's mention a bit about XV6. I mentioned XV6 before. Our first assignment is going to be adding two system calls to XV6. And it has the XV6 download instructions and so on. And also there's an book written by the XV6 authors which explains in a lot of detail how it works. We're going to go over how system calls work in XV6. I wanted to mention that the assignment involves adding them. Before I do that, so you maybe have other reasons to pay attention besides just being interested in how it works. Some notes on technical requirements for XV6. You'll need a Linux environment, though probably some non-Linux environments that are Unix-like will work. I just can't give good tech support for them. People have definitely had success using the Windows subsystem for Linux on Windows or OS X natively, though you'll need to install some software that is not so common, namely a cross compiler. And a copy of QEMU, which is the emulator we'll be using. So it's kind of like a virtual machine, like VirtualBox, but it's lower level. It's not as fast, but it's easier to run things in and supports like attaching GDB, which might be useful. And the assignment's not going to be released until a week from Friday, so. And due the following week, so that's 2 weeks from tomorrow. So XV6 includes a kernel. So we talked about the kernel being that part that runs in kernel mode. And it has a very small set of system calls. And I say Unix-like, it's like less than what modern Unix does. It has a standard library that implements some things like printf and so on, but it's very limited. So not the like full-featured library you're used to. And it has a few example programs, like a shell, ls, makedir, echo, very simple command line programs. Now, I said that the user space library and the system calls are very limited. And this shows up immediately when you look at an example program in XV6. So here's XV6's echo program. So echo is a program where if you run it from the command line, you'll run a command like, you know, this will be your prompt, and you'll type like echo foo bar, and it will print out foo and bar. So it prints out its arguments. And the XV6 version, it uses a loop over its arguments, which are stored in the argv array, which you may or may not remember from 2150. And argc is the length of that array, starting at index 1, because index 0 is the string echo. And it prints them out with printf, with a space between them if it's not the last argument, or a new line at the end. We notice that this printf looks a little weird. Like, what's the 1 doing there? And XV6's printf is different. It's kind of more like fprintf. It prints to a particular file. But files in XV6, as we'll learn later, are identified with a file descriptor number. And file descriptor number 1, by convention, is output. It's normal output. So that says print to standard out, basically. So on normal Linux, you might have written this as fprintf standard out. Yeah, and it's equivalent to that. And then you might notice that instead of returning from main, we call exit, which takes no arguments. And this is actually necessary. If we don't do that, if we just return from main, it turns out that we're going to crash because nothing actually called main. So when we're running on a normal like Linux program, something actually calls main, and that's why you can return. But here, the way XV6 works, there's no code that actually calls main, so you can't return. So instead, you need to do something else, and usually that something else will be exit. So questions? These oddities in this program here? Yes?
Why is it percent S twice?
What? Why is it percent S twice? So the way printf works is that this percent S matches to the next argument, and the next percent S matches to the following argument. So we're printing one of the arguments and either the string space or new line. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So you're saying that like in XV6, like nothing actually calls main, but like how does it code?
This question, how does main get run? Yeah. So when the operating system starts running the program, switching to user mode, it starts at the beginning of main. So it like jumps to main but doesn't call it, is how I'd look at it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and let's do a brief demo. So when you download XV6, it needs to be even bigger. So you'll extract something like, well, a directory that will look something like this. You can, something set up, you can type make to compile everything. And then you can use a command. So there's a make QMU runs it in QMU with a window, and make QMU no X runs it in QMU in your current terminal. I'm going to use the current terminal because it will display better for you. And it will give you a shell. And I mentioned that there's an LS program. It's a very, very underfeatured LS program. It gives you like the file sizes and identifiers. There's the echo program we saw, so on, and a few other programs you could look at. There's makedir and so on. And we can also have a shutdown command. So that's what it looks like. And yes, as I mentioned, so do 2 weeks, we'll have an assignment with that. So questions on six. There are instructions for that, the first assignment. Show that it is, in fact, real. So for our last 5 minutes and getting into next time, we're going to look at how system calls work in XV6. So on XV6, the way we write something to a file, including our standard output, our terminal, is with a system call called write. And this is an example of using write kind of directly. So here is my XV6 hello world program. I call write, and the arguments I take here are I take the file to write to. So this one means standard out, as we mentioned before with printf. The data to write. So this is the data to write, and the length to write. Number of bytes. So the length of our string, if I counted correctly, is 13 characters. So this writes hello world, and then exits. Yes?
Does this write serve the same as printf?
So this question, does this write the same as printf? So this has the same effect as printf, but printf's implementation is gonna would be way more complicated to look at because it needs to like look percent s and so on, which we are not gonna be concerned with in this exploration. Other questions? Or follow up? Yeah. The question 13 means there are 13 bytes. So the way this works is this is writing bytes as if like bytes to a file. So printf is going to be implemented using this, in fact. If you look at the code that XV6 has for printf, it in fact calls write. It happens to call it one byte at a time, but it calls write kind of like this. So this is not a system call. This is a function call. We know it's a function call because that's how we call functions, right? It looks like a function we call in C. And what this is part of the function call interface that goes to our standard library. So there's a write system call, and commonly people programming on Unix will say, oh, this is how you call the write system call. And it does, but we're really calling a standard library function called write, whose only job is to call that system call. So what's going to happen is that that standard library function called write, we're going to call with a normal function call, the same way we'd call like a function we'd write, you know, our Fibonacci function or whatever. Going to use the same mechanism to call that. And that the standard library code is actually going to trigger the system call. And to do that, it needs to use a special instruction, an instruction which we could not write in normal C code. So it's going to have a little bit of assembly to do this. On XV6, that instruction happens to be this int instruction, int for interrupt. And it takes a number, which is going to be 64, which is what XV6 has chosen to identify system calls. So that's going to trigger an exception. And then we get to our system call interface. So it triggers an exception. The hardware is going to look up in something called an interrupt table what OS code to run to handle that exception. And then the XV6 kernel code will run and say, oh, you wanted to write something. Let me do that for you. And then our return from interrupt function will run, and the hardware will return back to the system call wrapper, which will return back to the program, back to me. So we're going to go over this process in lots of detail next time, and also talk then about something else we alluded to, which was context switches, which how do we switch from one program to another. So before I finish questions, before people leave, we're all good.